Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. We have a great treat. Bill Binney joins us again, and his colleague Kirk Wiebe joins from Amsterdam, where they have a very exciting new venture that we're going to be talking about today. I think not only is it a very exciting business, but it's a very important business, and it's very important to us that they are in the world doing this. So I'm very glad you have the opportunity to hear all about it. Kirk and Bill, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
So I want to dive into the history, and maybe if each one of you could just give a minute or two on your history, first with the NSA, where your accomplishments were extraordinary, and then also the business you started in the U.S., and then we're going to dive into your new company, Pretty Good Knowledge.
Okay. Well, this is Bill, and I was basically in NSA. I was working on what I used to say is bits and bytes and letters and numbers. So I would solve things like code systems and data systems and work on crypt systems of all kinds. And so I was having a lot of technical fun and looking at large mounds of data and everything, trying to figure out massive amounts of information what's important to look at and what it means. And so I was working on human behavior in an electronic form. That is, when people do things electronically with the communications or with the devices and so on, what does that mean in the real world, you know? And what do the, when they're manipulating these things, what does that imply they're intending to do? So that's the kind of thing I worked on. I had a lot of fun doing it, and that's basically what the intelligence is all about, to be able to figure those things out and predict intentions and capabilities of potential adversaries. And that was primarily my objective there against the Soviet Union.
Now, you, your final position, I believe, was the Geopolitical World Technical Director. Is that correct?
It was basically the Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Shop. That was the full title, yeah. I thought that was fun.
Right. You were responsible to troll through all the data on the planet.
If there are problems the analysts were having, there were about 6,000 analysts involved in the process. And so I was their technical director. And basically, I was to look at the things that were causing problems for those analysts and were the biggest problems and what needed solved first and so on, and what were the technical ways to approach problems and resolve them. So,
okay, Kirk, so why don't you just give us a brief introduction?
Yes. Well, I actually began my intelligence career with the United States Air Force back in 1963. I had just graduated from high school, and I wasn't ready for college. I needed to have a little more time, more exposure to world events, and settle down a bit. So I went in the military. They discovered I had a penchant for languages and sent me to a Russian language school. And within a nine-month period at Indiana University, I picked up 4 years of Russian taught by native speakers hired by the U.S. Department of Defense. And to teach Air Force guys how to understand Russian. After that, went to some technical training to learn how to operate a shortwave receiver, because my job was going to be looking for, intercepting, recording, and maybe processing, if I could, Russian military communications overseas. So I spent assignments in Turkey and Japan doing that. Then getting out of the military, I returned to college, Indiana University, picked up a bachelor's and subsequently a master's degree in Russian, and then wrote the National Security Agency, and they said, come on down, we'd love to talk to you. So I became a Cold Warrior back with the Air Force that continued with NSA. NSA will tell you there are basically four disciplines it's involved in. And the first one is collection of information. You have to have data to look at. if you're going to produce intelligence. Then you have to process it, you have to analyze it, and you have to report it. And I worked in all four of those aspects of the business. And that basically, for me, culminated in 1991 when I was awarded the second highest award that NSA bestows on people, the Meritorious Civilian Service Award for work done against foreign strategic weapons systems. Then when Bill and I saw NSA turn to the dark side and actually weaponize surveillance, data collection against American citizens, which was absolutely forbidden by law, we decided that we couldn't go in that direction. And we parted ways with our alma mater, so to speak, walked out of the building, threw away our badges, and decided to eventually put them on report and tell the American people what had happened.
So if I'm not mistaken, you both left in October 2001, right after the Patriot Act passed.
Yeah, it was October 31st, Halloween Day, 2001. We went out the door, and basically when I left the door, I said, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, free at last.
So one more quick question, because there's a wonderful documentary that I encourage and have encouraged all of our subscribers to watch, but I encourage you again if you haven't, called A Good American. And it tells the story, among other things, about your work on Thin Thread and then the decision of the U.S. government to go with a different program. And I'd love for you to just give a little description and summary of that.
Okay, well, Thin Thread was our program that we developed to basically look at haystacks of data and find the needles and pull out only the needles and let the haystack go right by. So fundamentally, what we were able to do was to look at basically all the electronic communications down fiber optic lines and see in there through various technical means or rules, deductive, inductive, abductive type rules, figure out in there what was important to pull out for our analysts to look at for targets they were analyzing, like terrorism and international crime and other militaries and governments and things of that nature, things that were legitimate foreign targets for the United States. So we had a program that we developed, which we called Thin Thread, that was able to do that and do it on a very large scale on the order of, well, our first objective was to do 20 terabytes of data a minute. That's like four or five libraries of Congress every minute, if you think of that data. That's the amount of data we could look through at speed so we could keep up with it. But the reason we did the program to begin with was even back then in the early 90s, mid-90s, even back then, the way they were collecting data on the existing fiber lines was, at that time, even then, burying our analysts in too much data. I mean, I'd go around the different analysts we had working in the problem, in the out of the 6,000 analysts that I was involved with, they would say, we're just buried here. We can't get through it. Every day we get 50,000, 100,000 items, and we can't get through it.
Right.
And so, you know, it was basically making our analysts dysfunctional. So we had to figure out a way to do it that would effectively pull out only things that were necessary for them to look at so that they could solve their problem and actually succeed. And that was the problem even back then. Now it's orders of magnitude worse because of all the collection they've got worldwide now. So that's why they can't really stop anything in terms of terrorist attacks or things of that nature. Those things just happen simply because there's too much data to see and assess the threat and when and where it might happen. So they're having problems predicting intentions and capabilities because of the volume. But that was the whole idea behind our Thin Thread, was to make that a manageable problem. And we actually succeeded at it, but we did it too cheaply. So it meant that...
Well, you didn't collect all the data in the world and hand it over to private corporate contractors who could use it for a variety of different reasons.
Or to other governments or other agencies in the United States government that could also use it that way, like the FBI and the DEA and various law enforcement agencies who are using it today against people who are, you know, inside the United States committing, you know, just standard crimes. So,
well, I just say to everybody, if you're interested, I think The Good American is a wonderful documentary and will really help you understand the history. So then you left and you started a company called Entity Mapping. And I will just say, as a former government official and former contractor, I would say that you guys being available for hire would be an unbelievably attractive opportunity for many government agencies. I know you're marketing to government agencies, but in fact, the company was not wildly successful. So maybe you could describe why.
The problem was we actually did succeed wherever we went. And what it did was, I mean, one of the agency heads over there at one contract we had, I can't really tell you who it was with, but they said we're going to embarrass the, it was just Kirk and I, so, and they said about us that we're going to embarrass the fort, meaning NSA. And so therefore we have to terminate our contract, which is what they did.
Well, you would certainly, you and Kirk together could blow the margins for a lot of big companies.
Yeah, I know. See, that's why they also had to get rid of us, because we threatened their profit margin.
Right.
You know, and so that, and together with the agency heads and NSA and various other agencies in the government, there were reasons why they got rid of us, because we
so the reality is, politically, it wasn't attractive to operate just marketing to the U.S.
That's right.
Government.
And we actually, the problem was we solved the problems. When you solve the problem,
exactly.
The government agencies don't have the problems to ask for more money. And that the money to the contractors. And that's what the contract, I mean, we even knew from some of the members of Congress, the staffs, that staff members, that that the outside major corporations were down in the committees in Congress lobbying to get our program killed. We even knew that back then. And the reason they were doing that was because we threatened their ability to get profits from a problem that they didn't want us to solve, basically, which we had.
Right.
And so we had to go. So they got rid of it.
Right. The gravy train depends on non-performance.
Exactly.
Right. So then you started to work a team in the Netherlands. When watching the documentaries, one of them, it showed you working with a team in the Netherlands, and that has now evolved in with you starting a company. Pretty good knowledge in the Netherlands. Why the Netherlands? What's the attraction? Now, everybody who listens to the Salary Report knows I love the Netherlands. But why don't you tell me why you're in the Netherlands?
Well, as it turns out, Catherine, when these Dutch guys approached us and said, how would you like to come out of retirement? You know, Bill, they found us in the condition of mixed emotions. On the one hand, we had tried three times, actually four, if you include while we were still at NSA, to bring our thoughts, our novel ways of thinking about information analysis on a large scale to the marketplace, actually to the government, four separate times and fail. And even though we actually succeeded in making new knowledge discoveries, discoveries of intelligence importance, it didn't carry the day. And for the reasons you just elucidated, we became a threat. We were so good that we became a threat.
Right.
We were even seeing into government planning. And I think that's what scared them the most. The fact that we were good enough to look at a data set, ask certain questions about anomalous conditions we were seeing, and saw that it was an attempt by the U.S. government to cover up certain aspects of their own operations. And so we became a threat in multiple ways.
Right.
To become both government and business. So these Dutch guys come and say, how would you like to join us? So Bill and I thought basically along these lines. There was a slow divide occurring between Europe and the United States, and that's happening even as we speak. The revelations about widespread surveillance, the revelations that large companies like Google and Microsoft were in bed with the U.S. government making data available, really bothered Europe more than it has seemed to bother a large percent of Americans. And so Europe mobilized its forces within the EU and was actively talking about strengthening privacy regulation and finally passed it, and it became into force this past May, called the GDPR, which is a way of describing privacy, but with real law and legal consequences behind it. And so under GDPR, if any company or organization, including government, spills your private data into the public domain, you are subject to a 20 million euro fine for each person involved. Imagine leaking 200 people, 300 people, 500 times 20 million each. So right. Severe penalties. So the mood here for privacy and taking steps to guard it was right for us. We didn't see the threat by big business over here the same as we did in the U.S. We couldn't get past that bubble. We couldn't get above that ceiling in the U.S. because they're so influential with Congress. But over here, not so much. So Bill and I decided to give it a try. What did we have to lose? Nothing. We were a little bit bored. We were not being mentally challenged back in the States, so we said, let's do it. So we do. We come over. We do a lot of prepping during 2017, eventually culminating in our own BV, the equivalent of an LLC called Pretty Good Knowledge, standing up officially on 1 November 2017. And here we are in 2018. We've got a number of customers working on others, going through all the growing pains of a startup, working together, learning to work with one another, and succeeding, by the way, along the way, and even getting some bites in the U.S. And so we're actually thinking about expanding into the U.S. now.
So I asked you earlier, who's your perfect client? And we'll talk about that in a second. But apparently the U.S. may be, you may consider working with U.S. companies because I know of several who are going to be listening to this. But first, let's talk about Pretty Good Knowledge. Tell us what the company is, what it does. Tell us about your products and services.
Yes. We actually target any organization who's interested in achieving what we call situational awareness. Now, if you go into military jargon and you just Google something called situational awareness, we are bringing those concepts to the enterprise. Now, what's the essential operating principle in situational awareness? It's to be aware so that you're not surprised. The more the world unites under the internet and is exposed to life-changing, business-changing opportunities using digital information to communicate, share messaging, evolve and grow, it also brings with it threats. You hear about things like cybersecurity, people hacking into systems, downloading data, all of that. Dirty stuff comes with this wonderful thing called the internet that joins the world in a conversation. So what we bring is the ability to sort that out, and also the ability to leverage data relevant to any organization that's out there that we can get legally that bears on a organization's business questions.
So it's not only an organization's own data. So, for example, my web stats could be, who my customers are, marketing data. It's all the data available publicly.
Absolutely. Because you don't exist in a vacuum. You have competitors. You have areas of interest that are outside your own data holdings. And so data is unifying across the globe, and people want to be able to leverage that which is relevant to their activity.
Right.
And that's what we can do. And Beyond that, there's a more technical aspect. So collecting the data, and where did we just talk about that? NSA, that's a core competency at NSA, collect data. You have to process it if you're going to analyze it. And so the other piece that we bring to the table is a very unique ability to cross-correlate. In other words, bring disparate facts across data sets, both internal mm-hmm. and external, together in near real time, so that you build a kind of a knowledge output of this process that is, that optimizes your personal ability to manage your organization.
So can you give us some examples of clients and things you've done for them?
Yeah.
Well, we actually have done for some clients, lawyers and so on who are involved in lawsuits, actually correlating things like different companies involved that are assisting in criminal activity, for example. And we did this, basically this came out of some work we actually did back in 2004 and 5 for Customs and Border Protection. What happened was we went down and figured out a way of actually helping them isolate people attempting to smuggle imports and exports throughout the world, and especially into the United States or out of the United States. We could actually figure out which companies who were. This is all based on open source data in terms of advertising on websites for companies or in yellow pages and things like that. We figured out the techniques to figure out what companies were smuggling things. A lot of them we found out were Iranian. These are the ones we found that were, and some of them ended up in a court indictment. But the other ones we had, specifically for Customs and Border Protection, we proposed that we would do their entire data set, everything they had. They had in digital form about 10 years worth of data, and it represented about 500 million records. Now, a record for them might be one ship with 1,000 cars, you know. So that numbers of records don't necessarily tell you the amount of things being imported. But
right.
The point was they had a fairly good-sized data set that we could work on. And from the work we had done separately on this other project for these lawyers and so on, we estimated that from the data set that they had, we could produce on the order of 40,000 targets to look at immediately from the first run. And it would basically allow us to tell all their port inspectors for ships or planes with packages coming in what container to look in and what package in that container to look to find the contraband.
Right.
And so we were trying to improve port security for every port in the United States. And then, of course, we wanted to do the world because this technique applied to everything in the world and every port in the world. It wasn't necessarily restricted to just U.S. ports. So, but when we told them the amount of things that we would produce for them and give them to pass to their inspectors, I think it scared them. And so they fired us for customs. They said, well, we only have two analysts here, but you got thousands of inspectors. You don't have to worry about it. You're distributing the work will be distributed. Oh, it doesn't work. No, it's not. That's too much success, you know? So at any rate.
Well, there's maybe some places and times they don't want you to be successful.
Yeah, that's right. And certainly they don't want us here. I mean, it's just a shame that we have such people in positions of authority within our government agencies that they can't take advantage of actually solving things and seeing I guess what it means is they cannot see how they could cope with the success and with the understanding that if something happens and they were told about it through this success and they didn't do anything, they would be blamed, you know? And so there's this, I guess it's a sense of inadequacy to handle the real problem. And so they don't even try. So,
well, there's another thing, and that is if you look at the economic model that's happening, certainly within the G7, you have the economy very dependent on some covert flows. And so there's a real sensitivity about how you handle politically shutting down a covert flow.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you can't just – the idea of sending data out to hundreds of inspectors without being prepared to handle the sensitive ones – it was funny when we were leading the HUD loan sales, I would insist on seeing, you know, who owned what in the portfolio, because they were going to lose, you know, they were probably going to lose control of the property as a result of defaulting on the mortgage. But I wanted to know who was going to get burnt, because some of them could scream very loudly. And if you weren't prepared to handle it, you could really get in a mess. So,
I would also point out, when we did this, we also looked at and found Bernie Madoff in this, using this technique.
Yep.
So we found out, you know, that he had many, many positions involved in some operation, and it made it suspicious to us based on this technique we'd been using.
So tell us about the perfect client. Who's your perfect client?
Okay. So I mentioned earlier situational awareness. Now, the question is, how do you achieve that?
Right.
The how is critical, and it's not magic sauce. It's actually a discipline. And it's a discipline that Bill and I learned after many years of struggling with various kinds of data, how you exploit it, how you correlate it, in order to understand what some entity that you're studying out there or group of entities working together in a threatening, potentially threatening activity, how they're doing what they're doing, why they're doing what they're doing, and what's it look like, so that we actually develop profiles of activities over time as we would study these entities and their behavior in data. And so we learn to attribute meaning to changes in data profiles, timing, all of those different aspects of data processing, data analysis, to gain insights that were unparalleled.
So I'm from the investment world, and when I look at a company or a portfolio, I'm trying to define what their risks are and how to lower them. You know, one of the classic models is you find a company, you invest in it, and then you quickly reduce the risk that you had perceived. How would your situational awareness analysis compare to what an investor would do in terms of identifying and understanding risk?
I think understanding risk, if we're thinking about just beyond the limited topic of risk to investment, but actually what I call total risk, from all aspects that risk can come. It can come from within the organization, insider operations, theft from the inside, and it can come in the form of attack and attempts to steal money from the outside. And so you've got to understand the data systems that support those kinds of activities, and the techniques for detecting misuse, strange behavior. And so once again, it goes into understanding the data and what the exploitation opportunities are that reveal anomalous behavior, behavior that warrants further investigation, so that you can track down people who are doing things that increase risk. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so I'm still not clear. Who's the perfect client?
Okay.
Is it a business or a government or?
Okay. Now I'm going to read you that piece.
Good.
Okay. Yep. This way I will not forget to address some aspect, because it does require a lot of thought when someone says, what's the ideal client? So the ideal client is any company that wants to achieve situational awareness, awareness of its internal operations, what is going on. And I say that in all aspects of that, performance, what parts are working, which parts are failing, where do you need improvement, all the metrics and the auditing that goes along with all of that. So the ideal automated decision intelligence architecture application is one in which a real-time awareness of developments, both internal and external, to an enterprise is of paramount importance to leadership, those who steer the enterprise. This means, for example, the enterprise CXO level desires to be informed of a significant internal change affecting the enterprise, say a change in productivity, problems in the supply chain, new performance goals met, so it's not just bad information, it's good information as well.
Right.
As well as those developments that are external to the enterprise, market sector buy opportunities to increase market share, adverse weather conditions that threaten operations, and the ability of people to get to work. Note that each of these points of information reflect diverse data sources and sets of information. Indeed, some may involve multiple types of data sets within data sources. The challenge is to identify what data sources have the highest likelihood of providing relevant, high-quality answers in response to business information needs at all levels of the enterprise, and to ensure the knowledge gained is shared with the right processes and people to optimize decision-making wherever and whenever possible. Now, notice I use the words sharing knowledge with processes, not just people. That's because we want to leverage business rules wherever possible to maximize the opportunity to automate as many processes that machines do better than human beings and gain speed and error-free data.
Right, because all the potential people you could work for have the same problem that the NSA analysts had. They're all being overwhelmed by data.
Exactly. That's right. And so I'm going to continue. The architecture addresses enterprise policies and legal responsibilities early in the workflow to ensure compliance throughout the organization. Whether matters involving sensitive or classified information or simply concerns for privacy, compliance steps are inherent in the design. They are not tacked on afterthoughts. Note that each of the aforementioned points of information reflect diverse data sources and sets. Indeed, some may involve multiple types of data sets. The challenge is to identify what is the information having the highest probability to answer the business question. This is the architecture's core competency, and that is correlate the right information to get the right understanding, the right knowledge in the hands of people who can action it. Should an organization require the discrete handling of information, we encrypt it with very novel unparalleled security and privacy through an encryption algorithm that no one else features. That's a key point. The enabling correlation engine that we use is a key component. The engine brings together the diverse facts, providing a comprehensive picture of events of critical importance to the enterprise. The resulting knowledge is shared with those who need to receive it in a form that's easy to comprehend and as quickly as possible in support of the sense and respond model. The enabling kernel of the correlation engine is the entity graph table, defined and implemented to ensure the correlation process leverages both behaviors in data and attributes over time to build and maintain relationships across all data sources serving the organization. ADIA is the architecture, the automated decision intelligence architecture, develops and captures knowledge over time. As the organizational knowledge base matures, the enterprise is ever more able to implement an increasing number of business rules that in turn improve the quality and number of its decision-making processes. In this way, ADIA is a learning process that continuously proves the functional capabilities, enabling it to respond effectively to virtually any scenario for which its data sources are intended to inform. Finally, as the final component in the continuum of knowledge development and with a solid enterprise knowledge base as the enabler, the enterprise is able to develop and leverage patterns and profiles that in turn serve as the building blocks of predictive analytics, the process of predicting outcomes. The result, an information-dominant enterprise capable of responding to virtually any event, any development, whether internal or external to the organization, in an effective and manageable way.
So the bottom line is your job is to significantly increase the learning metabolism in the organization that hires you.
Yes.
Right. So let me ask two questions that every business that I talk to today always asks me. One is cybersecurity. Is the process you're describing one that will help them significantly with cybersecurity?
Yeah, that's one of our major concerns. We do different things like encrypt all of your data sets in a unique encryption that isn't publicly known. So it's not something that exists for any other agencies or other companies who might want to try to break into your data. But we also like to monitor who's in your data network at the same time. It was one of the programs that NSA got rid of out of our thin thread program. It was a program that monitored the network log where you could see everybody who's coming into your network, where they're going, what they're doing, how long they stay, and so on, so that you could detect whether or not what they were doing was something that was permissible in your network or not. In other words, we could have picked up on all kinds of illegal transfers of money between programs and things of that nature that might be done by management and NSA. This is one of the reasons they killed it, because they didn't want Congress to know what they were doing with the money that they gave them. So that was one of our problems. You know, we made things too easy for people to understand and see, and they couldn't – basically, it made it so that they couldn't hide anything. So we obviously had to go. But that's one of the things that we like to incorporate in our business process, because it allows you to it also allows you to stop people coming into your network. If you if you're trying to protect something from someone, you can see people entering your network. There are various programs out there that do that, and you can marry that up with your business and actually see and stop people from entering your business if you don't want them there.
Right. The second one question I get is, what does, and I'll just insert the phrase deep learning, what does deep learning mean to my company? You know, how do I deal with it in the marketplace, and then how do I use it to my advantage?
You want to take that one, Kirk?
Yeah. Well,
you're in the deep learning.
Yeah. Deep learning for us means the IDEA architecture, the system supporting the enterprise, is a learning process. Over time, it gets smarter, and as it gets smarter, it gets more effective. Does that include what typically people call AI? No. We do not believe AI is where it needs to be. We want to make sure that we have a human controlled process at every step of the way. Not to say that there aren't highly repetitive tasks in data management that are better served by a machine than a human. It's just that when thinking becomes critical, we don't want to hand that over to the machine. It's not the
When I read a lot of people who describe deep learning AI, what it really is just a ton of algorithms.
Yes, exactly.
It's not really what I would describe as artificial intelligence.
Exactly, and we don't call it artificial intelligence.
No, we don't use that term.
Right, okay, good.
One of the things we do that, as far as I know, no one else does, is we go in and correct the data that you have in databases. So, in other words, we look at it. That's one of the primary problems, is that a lot of the data is input by people from, you know, any numbers of people, maybe with different first languages and things of that nature. So they create errors, or they make standard human errors when they enter data, misreading characters or perhaps using abbreviations that are variable for the same company name or for the same kinds of statements in data about the company. So we go in and actually look at that and correct it. You could call it a form of normalizing data, but we're making it, we're correcting it to the corrected version. And you can see that in the data, that the data itself will tell you what the correct version is if you get enough of it over time. You can, by standard frequency counting and things like that, you can actually figure out what the correct version is and actually see, according to the rules we have, the errors that people are making and what kind of error it is, too, and then fix it.
So of the assignments you've had or the ones you expect, what do you think, what percentage of the data do you think you're accessing internal to the organization, and how much do you think is external?
A good deal of that, though, does require cooperation from the giving from the company we're servicing. You know, whether or not they will allow us into their data. Sometimes they aren't prepared to expose certain sets of data to us. So,
right.
You know, and that's okay. I mean, but it means that we are limited in what we could do for them. The more we have that we can look at, the better job we could do for them. So. But it's a matter up to them as to what they would feel comfortable with. But it's kind of hard to guess. So far, perhaps with some of the companies, I don't think we've looked at more than say 20 to 30% of their data. Some of them.
But then, how much are you drawing on data that's external, like you know, weather or general databases that are external to the organization?
Yeah, see, some of that's a variable depending on the job that's involved. For the lawyer, the job we were using primarily was primarily data from the international web and scraping sites and things of that nature. So that's a little bit different. For some of the other companies we worked at, they were interested in weather, and a lot of that was external to them. But
right.
We'd also look at internal, limited amounts of internal data as to where who had the requirements to know about the data and things of that nature. So we need to know distribution and all that kind of information about the structure and who needed to be notified when certain things were occurring.
Right.
So that was kind of it's kind of a variable. So it's kind of, I don't know that there's anything that's a standard.
One thing I would say, one of the reasons I think it's hard to describe what you can do is every company, every agency is different.
Yep.
And what's interesting is if you look at your history at the NSA, I'm sure the number of times that you've had to go and assess a situation and design a custom solution, you know, is so many that you're used to doing that. But it sounds to me like the process is similar, but the result for each company is unique depending on who they are, what they need, how it works. One of the products you describe is education as well. So you're willing to help the organization get a lot more knowledgeable. So if you could describe, I love the name, Pretty Good Academy. What is Pretty Good Academy and how does it fit in?
Well, I mean, yeah, what we're trying to do is to teach these kinds of techniques as to how to find out how to discover knowledge in data and how to arrange it, organize it, analyze it, approach it. You know, how is it that you can see things in data that others cannot? And that's basically the whole idea behind it. Plus, at the same time, what we're trying to say is you need to also look at the business you're involved with and actually the business rules they use to take actions within their business environment.
Right.
So, and we try to formalize that in as much as we can into a formal process that we can code and execute in computer software, which means we are automating the process of decision making in that business.
So let's say I'm a company and I'm, you know, I don't know you guys yet. I know of you. I'm impressed by your background, your experience, your reputation, but I'm a little scared about going naked. Is Pretty Good Academy a way I can start with you where we get to know you because you make me smarter and that makes me smarter so I can start to bring you in? Is that a good way for me to start?
Oh, sure, because that gives you the idea of some of the techniques and processes that we are involved in actually implementing. Yeah, absolutely.
So Pretty Good Academy on your website, you say it's like a week's process. Is there any way you could do it? You know, what's the shortest Pretty Good Academy you can have with a company that's trying to get to know you?
I think you could. Okay.
Yeah, I would differentiate the academy from, say, a CEO's or even a CIO or any CXO level or even mid-level management who wants to know about what we offer. That would be a short-term consulting, or actually just a presentation, maybe over a couple of hours. That would still be the best for that kind of a discussion. If the discussion is, can you make my data experts better and expand their horizons and the way they think about analyzing data on its internal networks or even external? Yes, that would be the academy, where we can broaden the typical exposure they get in schools, universities, and other training programs.
Right. So you're basically talking at the data analyst or IT analyst level. You're not
right.
So a pretty good academy is to train the implementers, so to speak. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. Ever since I first interviewed Bill Binney on the Solaire Report, I've had a fantasy, and that is when I asked you, Bill, I don't know if you remember this, you know, what are some of the things, actions we can take to really make a big difference in this world? You said what I thought was one of the smartest ideas I've heard yet, which is, you know, let's teach all the kids how to build encryption systems, and then we'll drive them crazy.
That's right.
That is true.
Yep, that's right.
So one of the, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about is, okay, well, how could we implement that? How do we, you know, one of the things I was hoping you guys would do is make a webinar that would teach all the kids to do encryption systems.
Well,
anyway, so
one of the concepts that we're using here is a kind of a unique way of dealing with encryption. You know, virtually every encryption I know of that is in use anywhere in the world is basically a single dimension. You start the encryption process and it keeps generating, you know.
Right.
And so, but instead of doing that, and in terms of blockchain, you know, they use that encryption when you get the various information elements that enter and get encrypted. You have to index always back to the original version, all that varying encryption over time. Well, we invent a multi-dimensional encryption system that basically enters layers of complexity that eliminates the blockchain requirement of mapping various encrypted versions. You always get the same encrypted outcome for a given input.
Right.
So you can index it with and it eliminates all the requirements of mass indexing all kinds of data over long periods of time.
Okay, well, one of the things I just want to say, because I know some of the companies that are going to be listening to this, what I would say is, you know, this is a company that really can make your business and you smarter. And so I would reach out and see if you can't start engaging. I think some people, Bill, are going to be afraid you guys are too high-powered for them.
Actually, we're quite down-to-earth.
What?
Well, let me interject something here, Catherine.
Okay.
The sophistication of the total process called ADIA, the Automated Decision Intelligence Architecture. It's true. It's somewhat complex, and it takes a while to implement it in terms of educating the receiving organization on how to use it.
Right.
However, I would tell you that we're very comfortable with first steps. In other words, at every juncture, there's about an 8 or 9 step build that creates this architecture. Even the first 1 or 2 steps will benefit any organization. The first one being deciding what data is most important for your enterprise. That's a small step. It's more of a discussion and a small implementation. The second one is, how do you correct data? Data invariably has errors, and most people ignore them. And you do that to the peril of the quality of your decisions. So we actually can take the next step a little more sophisticated and using some automation to correct data automatically, so that your data is available to the enterprise. And then we validate data, which is a sort of a step in correction, but it's more about deciding or making sure you're leveraging high confidence data.
Right.
In the enterprise. So these are minor steps that can be taken to benefit anyone's situation. You don't have to swallow the whole pill.
Right. And I, you know, it's always amazing to me to watch people's eyes light up when they see really great knowledge management go to work and help make them smarter. They just can't, you know, they can't believe it's all possible, but it is. Okay. So now I have to just ask you a personal question. You're flying back and forth between two continents. You're starting a new business. You're running into all the different, I call it the data beast, all the sensitive issues that come up when you deal with data and applying it to, you know, real world process. So let me ask the question, are you having fun?
Well, I think, yes, I would say I'm starting to have fun, sure, because it means that I get the opportunity to look at all kinds of problems and figure neat and novel ways of solving them.
Right. So you're also spending time in one of the great cities of the world, Amsterdam.
Yeah, that's right. It's everybody here speaks English, so it's really great, you know.
Well, you don't live in unless you constantly learn, and so that's what Bill and I are doing. We're learning everything from Dutch to Dutch culture. Learning that Dutch is quite difficult, in fact.
Well, you speak Russian. Dutch can't possibly be that difficult.
It is. It's more difficult. The only thing that makes Russian difficult is the Cyrillic alphabet. Once you get past that, the rules are pretty general, just like in English, although English is a little bit more hokey in that sense. But Dutch is a mishmash of so many languages, and they even, as you know, Catherine, yourself, they drop out of Dutch and into English in a split second, interject an English phrase and go right back into Dutch.
Right. Except where I am, which is they start talking Frisian if they really don't want you to understand.
One of our team members, actually two of them in pretty good knowledge, are from Friesland. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yes, they are.
All the and, you know, it's a great freedom fighter area. So
it is. It is. Yeah. And we have a lot of fun talking about that.
Well, you know, it's the problem I have is with language. Is I'm a mathematician, of course. So when they keep dropping in and out of English, I had to ask one of our Dutch partners. I said, "Is there a specific set of English that you tend to use in your speaking when you go in and out of Dutch to English and back and forth?" And they said, no, it's just random, anything you want. Well, I mean, you know, for a mathematician, that's not a rule. So, you know, you're violating the basic principles of rules. So this variability is hard for mathematicians to handle.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me. I know it's very late in the Netherlands, so I won't keep you. But if you could describe your website, just point us to your website and tell us if people are interested in contacting you and following up with you. How do we go about engaging with you on a transactional basis?
Well, there is a form on our Pretty Good Knowledge website, so you can visit that. But Bill and I also have individual websites. I think mine's kirkwiebe.org. And I think Bill's is billbinney.org.
Or com.
It could be .com, but we don't pay attention to our own websites so much. Yeah. We're so eager dealing with other information. But there's little vignette stories and media sources on interviews we've had and things of that nature on that.
Okay, so if I'm a company and I'm interested in talking to you about Pretty Good Knowledge or Pretty Good Academy, I should come into the Pretty Good Knowledge website and fill out the contact form.
Absolutely.
Okay.
In fact, one of our current customers did just that, and we're highly engaged with them now.
So before we close, anything else you want to mention about Pretty Good Knowledge or what you're doing? Anything we forgot to cover?
I don't think so. Just I want to make sure that people are not frightened by what we bring to the table. We can ease anyone into this more advanced world of data management and data exploitation in a comfortable way. We don't have to rush things. It can be a very slow introduction or as quickly as someone would want to change their operation.
Well, one thing I will stress, and we've talked about this a lot on the Solaria report, we're going into a world where, you know, data is growing exponentially.
Yes.
And the need to make sense of it is growing. You guys have one of the best resumes on the planet in doing that. You certainly weren't an organization that threw, you know, as much data as there was at you. So, you know, I think if a company's looking for people who can help them learn to navigate this environment, you know, a relationship with pretty good knowledge is a place to begin. So I hope we help to get the word out. If there's anything else we can do to get the word out, please let me know, and I will absolutely reach out to you. I'm going to be in the Netherlands in the second 2 weeks of February and the 4 weeks in March, and hopefully we'll cross paths. The last time I was flying in, the day after Bill was flying out. We just missed, but hopefully we won't in 2019. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me on the Solaria Report. You have a wonderful evening.
Yeah, thank you, and you too.
Catherine, thank you. Loved it, and the same to you.
Goodbye.